How you doing? All right, so tonight we're dealing with Parshas Shmos, and bringing up the topic of Paro, the king of Egypt, versus Hitler. So let's take a look at. I'm going to show you a little video, and this video okay, we got Jonathan. Welcome, Jonathan. Okay, this is a video of Nazi propaganda, and this was apparently 1940. And the Nazis were genius propaganda of delegitimizing the Jews, and they created a narrative about the Jewish people. So we're going to listen to it. It's 4 minutes long, translated from the original German. Those who get to watch it are certainly at an advantage. Here we go.
Insignificant there. Here at the Wailing Wall, they gather and mourn the fall of Jerusalem. It is a matter of choice, and in keeping with their entire history, 4,000 years ago, their Hebrew ancestors were already wandering, but the land of two river wandered along the sea to Egypt, where they ran a lucrative grain business for a while. When the country farmers and other Egyptians rose against the foreign usurers and speculators, they wandered once more and plundered their way to the promised land. They settled there, mercilessly looting the culturally superior rightful inhabitants. Here, in the course of centuries, from the Oriental Far Eastern racial mixture, with Negro and ultimate mongrelized Jews developed. Foreign from us Europeans, born of totally different racial elements, they differ from us in body and above all in soul. We probably would never have been bothered by them had they stayed in their Oriental home. But the cosmopolitan empire of Alexander the Great, reaching from the Near East across half the Mediterranean, and especially the boundless world empire of the Romans, brought about the evolution of the trade and migratory traits of the Jews, who soon spread across the open Mediterranean area, while some of them settled in the large urban traffic and trade centers of the Mediterranean. Others wandered relentlessly on across Spain, France, southern Germany, and England. Everywhere, they made themselves unwelcome. In Spain and France, the people rose openly against them in the 13th and 14th centuries, and they wandered on, mainly to Germany. There they followed the path of the Aryan culture, creative Germans colonizing the East, until they finally found a gigantic new untapped reservoir in the Polish and Russian sections of Eastern Europe. The 19th century, with its model ideas about human equality and freedom, gave the Jews a great lift. From Eastern Europe, they spread across the entire continent during the 19th and 20th centuries, and then across the world. Throughout the world is the migration of a similarly restless animal, the rat. Rats have been parasites on mankind from the very beginning. Their home is Asia, from which they migrated in gigantic hordes over Russia and the Balkans into Europe. It spread over all of Europe. Toward the end of the 19th century, with the growing shipping traffic, they took possession of America as well. And eventually, virtually Africa and the Far East. Wherever rats turn up, they carry destruction to the land by destroying mankind's goods and nourishing diseases and plagues, such as cholera, dysentery, and typhoid fever. They are deadly and cruel, and usually appear in massive hordes. They represent the elements of sneakiness and among animals, just as the Jews do among mankind.
Okay. How was that?
What do you say to that?
So let me ask you a little guiding questions here. What is the Nazi narrative about Jewish history? They started with Avram, but they didn't name Avram. How did they frame it as? How did they describe the Jewish migration from Mesopotamia to Israel down to not initially.
Like
that was later. They didn't start with that.
That was later.
Anybody catch that?
That the Jewish people would take over and wipe out whatever was already existing.
Well, they use different words. Would take over, infiltrate. They called them usurers. All the negative terms of Christian anti-Semitism for the last 2,000 years. He explained Jewish history. Now it's kind of funny that he's speaking to an audience that has some knowledge of the Jewish Bible, but he recasts the Bible, the story of the Avram coming from Mesopotamia to the land of Israel because God asked him. No, as you know, they're this Asian, Mongoloid, Negro creature came, going into King and dispossessing the rightful superior people there, and then come down and are grain speculators and usurers and thieves, and then go to Egypt, and then are kicked out, and then are sent out, and they're kicked out in various places. And they migrate, foreshadowing the analogy of the rat analogy at the end. Now, what's effective about this story?
It flushes the sense of for the soldiers, like the German soldiers and German citizens, it gives them like a sort of like, you know, this is why it's okay to do these horrific things to the Jews. Because they carry disease, they're going to destroy our culture, so it's okay to ship them off.
Right, they're human vermin. They're human rats. And now, but what's up? But I'm saying, what? Now here's a key point. Now, this is propaganda. What makes propaganda powerful or effective?
There's some truth in it. It's like a perverted truth.
Right. So, what true elements did the narrator capture in the narrative?
We did migrate. We did move.
We did move around.
We established large families in our communities and very strong communities.
So, notice he says that the people in, let's say, in Spain, in the 13th and 14th century, rose up and kicked us out. What was he obliquely referring to?
The Inquisition.
The Inquisition. It wasn't a kicking. It was basically they were told that they either accept Roman Catholicism, or they get burnt to the. You know, it wasn't a economic phenomena. It was a church based phenomena, and Right. So what Suzanne pointed out is correct. In other words, they taps on the fact that the Jews have been traveling from country to country, nation by nation to nation, but not as a as an animal seeking a weak victim to take advantage of, but rather the Jews were the persecuted ones, escaping one level of persecution to another. You know what I'm saying? So they sort of glossed over that. Also, took away any element of the Jewish chosenness, God's people, the Jewish people. The guy rewrote the, it's funny, he accepts the narrative of the Bible, but reconnects it. Basically, they're just grain speculators, thieves, usurers going from area to area. Takes a little bit about the Bible, like, you know, when the Jews, when Yosef in the end of Bereishis organizes for the Pharaoh for the benefit of having grain during the famine, all the grain, all the money, it wasn't the Jews gathering all the money, the livestock, and ultimately the people as serfs, it was Pharaoh with the direction of Yosef. You know what I'm saying? So he put it on as the Jews are scheming again. You know what I'm saying? Now, obviously, tragically, we know that this and so much more propaganda was tragically extremely successful because Hitler had, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of willing partners in his execution of the Jewish people. So this stuff is very powerful stuff. Okay. Now, what's the last piece of the little the rat analogy? And this is something that that the Nazi propaganda used time and time again.
I think you kind of mentioned it earlier, just these like mindless like animals going from space to space, you know, consuming all the resources and moving on, kind of.
And what else are they bringing with them?
Disease.
Very important. Now, Jewishly, what racial defects did we have?
Tay-Sachs. Did they know about that?
What?
Did they know about Tay-Sachs?
No, he said we had the mixture, race mixture of Asian, Mongolian, Negro. We're also Negro, apparently. So all the negative racist from a racist perspective, we had the mix of it. And then we are doing what? We are injecting, and because of what of the Enlightenment and he said the horrible ideas of freedom and all that, these ideas are now being infiltrated and affecting the great Europe. So the analogy is like a rat. Starts in Asia, Jews start in Asia, go from east to west, consuming resources, go in packs, bring cholera, typhus, disease, affect, and bring down all their host countries all over the world. So ultimately, it makes the Nazi initiative, they're the ultimate exterminators of evil. It's a great thing. All right. Okay, now I bring this up because we're going to see very quickly on, Paro also used propaganda. And the commentator that really develops as nicely is Nachmanides, the Ramban. So we're going to learn that tonight. That he's the star of the show tonight. We'll get to that. Let's get a little connection with the story. Shana Bavakasha, if you can read.
Sure. The original number of Yaakov's direct descendants, including Yosef, who was in Egypt, was 70. Yosef, Yosef, his brothers, and everyone else in that generation died. The Israelites were fertile and prolific, and their population increased. They became so numerous that the land was filled with them.
Okay. All right, so fine. So basically, the beginning of the book of Shemot, our Parsha Shemot, talks about that Yosef and his generation dies. They start with 70, and they have grown dramatically, a population explosion. Okay? Go on.
A new king who did not know of Yosef came into power over Egypt. He announced to his people, "The Israelites are becoming too numerous and strong for us. We must deal wisely with them. Otherwise, they may increase so much that if there is war, they will join our enemies and fight against us, driving us from the land."
I stop right there. Okay, so what is Paro accusing or bringing, what is the motivation of the Paro, the king of Egypt, to initiate decrees against the Jews?
They're growing to the point that they'll overthrow the dominant culture and that they won't, that they'll have political power.
Worse.
They'll ally themselves with Egypt's enemies.
Right. And they'll do what?
Fight against Egypt and remove the Egyptians from their land.
Right. And therefore they'll basically kick out the Egyptians and they'll take over. Now, this anti-Semitic accusation, this canard, if you will, has been repeated many times in things. There's another phrase for this. There's a phrase that captures this kind of accusation of disloyalty. Anybody know what it is? Called being a fifth column, or being a force. An enemy force, which is inside the good country. You know what I'm saying? That the Jews are going to be disloyal and are going to disregard all the many years of hospitality that the Egyptians have shown them and are going to join with their with the enemies of the state and work collaboratively to destroy the Egyptians by kicking them out. Okay? Was this accurate? Was it not accurate? What's going on here? What is animating him? What is at the center of his, of Paro's fear? What do you say, guys?
Is this a period of like famine in the land type of stuff?
What do you mean?
Like, are the Egyptian people themselves experiencing hardship?
Doesn't say. Doesn't seem to be a ton of famine. Do you think his depiction, the Israelites have become too numerous and strong for us? Is that a realistic concern?
No.
No.
Right. So he's having this sort of exaggerated anxiety attack. Okay, now the Torah has to open up that the king of Egypt did not know Yosef. Now, there's an obvious question here. There's an obvious question to that.
He is the viceroy of Egypt. How does he not know him?
Well, no, he's already dead.
Well,
how does he not know of him?
Right, it's like not knowing, you know, Yosef, like maybe a generation or two ago, had helped the previous administration, or a couple of administrations ago, organize itself and survive a epic famine. A. B. Allow the Pharaoh to consolidate control over all the people, gathering the wealth, the livestock, and the people into a serf-lord relationship. So what's the plain text of who did not know of Yosef? How would you read, what's the plain text of how you read, he did not know of Yosef? Give me a possible translation of that passage.
so much time has passed that he just has never heard of him, that it's not what he did wasn't relevant anymore.
Well, I mean, it's like not knowing about, you know, George Washington or Abraham Lincoln. Hard to not know about that.
It could be he knew of Yosef and what Yosef did, but he didn't know that Yosef himself was an Israelite or was Jewish.
Okay, so one thing is that he disassociated himself with the Jewish people, okay? He sort of assumed that that guy must have been what?
Egyptian.
Some sort of Egyptian. That's the Sforno's approach, okay? And he talks about how the Jews had become, you know, bug-like, and the previous became fertile and prolific. They became low people, while the aristocratic guests that the previous Paro or number of administrations ago were regal, aristocratic, genteel people, and these people were not as sophisticated or developed. So that's one possibility. Or even more simple. Give me a simple answer.
I feel like this
Yeah, David Goldstein.
Maybe he's alluding to his ignorance or his intelligence.
So, in other words, you're just saying that he was just profoundly ignorant of Egyptian history.
Possibly.
That's possible. Possible. There's been speculation about this Egyptian was not of the same Egyptian world. Maybe he came from a different kingdom. Possibility. Another possibility is that he did not know. I mean, he didn't pay attention to that fact. He had a certain mandate. He had a certain feelings. And he sort of willfully ignored it. Doesn't mean he didn't know about it factually. He didn't really pay attention to it. You know what I mean? We all know a lot of things, but we don't really want to pay attention to everything. You know what I'm saying? So it's sort of a willfully forget it, not focusing upon it. Okay. Now let's see the multi-tiered, and guys, I'm giving you a little heads up. The oppression of the Jewish people, and this is something you can keep for the Seder, are four distinct stages. Okay, so let's see you go. All right, back to you, Shana.
The Egyptians appointed tax officers over the Israelites to crush their spirits with hard labor. The Israelites were to build up the cities of Pitom and Ramses as supply centers for Paro.
But what does it mean by tax officers? What they call Sarei Nisim. What does tax officers have to do with the hard labor? Couple possibilities.
They're like the overseers for people who couldn't pay their taxes.
They're right. Like cops, like enforcers.
Right. So what did Michael Dove say? If they could pay, they didn't have to do it. Either that the tax was labor. Okay, one possibility. King Solomon himself said that in order to build the temple, everybody had to give like a month of labor. Okay, the one possibility is that the labor, the tax is a labor tax. You got to put in for the state free labor. One possibility. Second possibility with Michael Dove, and we'll explore this in the Ramban, is that you got to pay. But if you're a poor, and if you're a wealthy Jew, you're not enslaved. You wrote him a check and you went back to your house. You're a poor Jew. You couldn't pay the tax. You had to work. All right? And they built Pitom and Ramses, supply centers for Paro. Go on.
But the more the Egyptians oppressed them, the more the Israelites proliferated and spread. The Egyptians came to dread the Israelites.
Let's stop right there. What kind of word, what kind of terminology in the eyes of the Egyptians are the Jews described as?
Vermin or bugs.
Right. They're proliferating and they're spreading. Or the more they oppress them, they're more they're growing and they're spreading and they're everywhere. And the Egyptians became to dread. The Hebrew word is a little bit better, by yakutsu. They were like disgusted by them. In other words, they're like really, it bothered the heck out of them. Go on.
The Egyptians started to make the Israelites do labor designated to break their bodies. They made the lives of the Israelites miserable with harsh labor involving mortar and bricks, as well as all kinds of work in the field. All the them do was intended to break them. The king of Egypt spoke to the chief Hebrew midwives, whose names were Shifra and Puah. He said, when you deliver Hebrew women, you must look carefully at the birth stool. If the infant is a boy, kill it. But if it is a girl, let it live. The midwives feared God and did not do as the Egyptian king had ordered them. They allowed the infant boys to live. The king of Egypt summoned the midwives and demanded, why did you do this? You let the infant boys live. The Hebrew women are not like the Egyptians, replied the midwives to Paro. They know how to deliver. They can give birth before a midwife even gets to them. God was good to the midwives, and the people increased and became very numerous. Because the midwives feared God, he gave them great families of their own. Paro then gave orders to all his people. Every boy who is born must be cast into the Nile, but every girl shall be allowed to live.
Excellent. Okay. All right. So we answer the first question. What is the pretext for enslaving the Jews? The Jews are a growing and disloyal threat. They're going to join our enemies and attack us in our most vulnerable, in our ultimate vulnerability and kick us out of the land. Now, how does this differ from the Nazis?
Because they wanted to exterminate the Jews, not just have a slave workforce.
Well, did the Nazis enslave the Jews?
They did, but like the ultimate goal was to eradicate them.
The final solution.
Yeah.
Was there any genocide? Did the Egyptians do any genocide?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, they did. So there is a genocide component. Who's going to be the object of the genocide?
Male Jews.
The little boys. Now, it seems that this was not a decree for all time, because otherwise the only people leaving Egypt would have been 80-year-old men together with Moshe. So that's not the case. How is it different than the Nazis? One of the ideas you mentioned, Scott, is that they didn't have a final solution to eradicate all the Jews.
Right.
Mostly enslave them, some genocide. What else? How is Hitler different than Paro? And how are they the same?
Hitler was trying to empower, it seems, everyday Nazis or German people to hate the Jews. He doesn't seem to be doing that for all of Egypt.
Well, you see, it says they made them.
Was that every Egyptian, or is that just the tax officers and certain other people to control them?
Okay, that's good. That's good. It's not clear. Is that every Egyptian, or just people involved who were part of the officers of the state who had this extreme negative feeling toward the Jews? What else? What other distinctions? Before we go into the commentaries, let's do our, what else? Is there any? How else is Hitler
really, really hated the Jews, maybe more than Paro? Like, thought they were the absolute like worst. Like, he had a deep, deep hatred.
Correct. In other words, we saw from the propaganda film, the Nazi propaganda film, he maintained the Jews were intrinsically a people who were bug-like, in other words, they're an evil to what? They're an evil to the whole world. They're like, you got to get rid of disease. You got to get rid of rats because they're breeders of disease. What is Paro's concern?
Basically that they're just going to, overthrow him and take over the lands.
Right. So his concern is not so much they're an inherent evil. They're just a competitor for power. And if they would suddenly leave, he would have no problem with them. He wouldn't go chasing them around to the end of the earth. The Nazis want to kill every Jew on the earth, wherever they may be. And whatever land they had access to, they did their very best, and they were very effective to murder every Jew they could. I mean, one of the blessings is when the fact that the British were able to stop the Germans moving eastward toward Palestine, because their interest was to conquer Palestine, the modern state of Israel, and for the 100,000, 200,000, 300,000 Jews, what would they do there? He would have killed them all. It would have been a horrendous situation. They're able to stop him in El Alamein, a famous battle, the British. Okay. So let me ask you this question. So if he's concerned that they are a threat to their security, why didn't he just simply murder them, annihilate them?
Because he needed a workforce that he could, just build these things with and not have to really pay them at all.
He doesn't start off to his people, whether his staff, whoever the people are, and say, look, we got to build Pitom and Ramses, and we don't have enough money in the treasury to pay people to work, so we need to find a vulnerable group of people that we can enslave. Is that what he's
maybe
doing?
It's like if they're working all the time, they don't have any time to procreate?
Well, that's the idea, but so it seems to be not essentially about getting free labor. The labor is to be able to crush them, so they become no longer a force. But a simple question, why don't you just kill them all? He's the Paro.
I think he sounds like he needed a political solution that was palatable to people, and just going out and killing your neighbor doesn't sound the most doable or sane.
Right, and this is like the same thing that the Nazis were doing. It's like a palatable justification of these horrific things.
Correct. In other words, even if you'd want to get rid of all the Jews, these people were invited aristocratic guests. You can't just tell your people, the people who are now have diplomatic immunity from a previous administration has been given land from the Egyptian state to be able to enjoy and live, and then we're going to line them against the wall and just shoot them dead. So even the Nazis could not start with the extermination. They had to do a multi-year process to create tremendous disdain and hatred toward the Jewish people before they can pull it off. And Hitler was very concerned that the world was going to be bothered by the fact that he was killing the Jews. And when he saw that people were not so upset about it, and people were not upset, when they knew about it and they saw they can get away with it, he went all the way. He took the ball all the way down the field.
One example. Sorry to just jump in, but what happened was also with the Elian Conference was that no one would take the Jews besides the Dominican Republic. So his first step was that he realized that that people wouldn't take Jewish people. So he realized that the world wasn't really watching, and that also led to extermination. So it wasn't just murder. Yeah.
Correct. Initially, at one point, he was willing to deal. Well, if you want the Jews, but the countries of the world would not open up their doors, including the United States, tragically. Okay. All right, so what were the four stages of the slavery? Who can tell me? We read through it. Who can tell me? Four stages. Don't all yell at once.
Was the first stage the tax in the form of hard labor?
Right. The first thing is the tax, which can either it's a work tax or a work if you can't pay tax. Step one. Next.
Physically abuse them.
Then turn up the heat and make the labor really backbreaking, where the goal is to simply break them. know what I'm saying? Really crushing work, okay? Step three, when that was not really effective, step three.
The covert genocide through the midwives?
Yeah, now, it's not that there are only two midwives for all the women. They're probably the executive directors of the Midwife Association. Yeah. Is in charge of all the women. You know what I'm saying? They're not just two women delivering all the babies for all the Jewish people. It means that they're in charge of the midwife. You know, they're the administrators. Okay. Now you could read as chief Hebrew midwives as they're Jewish women, which is the way that Rashi says. Shifra and Pua is really Yocheved and Miriam, one possibility, or they're non-Jewish midwives who are in charge of delivering the Jewish people. It's another way of reading it, which makes them even more amazing because they basically lie to Paro. Because basically, what do? Did they kill any Jewish boys?
No.
So then, of course, Paro's angry. He calls them in for a little conference. And what happens? He says, what did you do? You let the boys live. And what was their answer?
What can we do?
They're afraid of God, yeah.
Well, they say, oh, we're afraid of God. They did not say that. They were fearful of God of being Paro's willing executioners. What's the reason they gave?
They said
too quick.
You know, these women also playing on the, the Nazis in their propaganda depicted the Jews in two extremes. Somehow having this sort of magical superpower ability to control stuff, like with money and world power, and simultaneously to the lowest bug. Okay, so they're like little magically weird, disgusting things. So they play upon saying, these women are amazing. They can deliver their own kids. And by the time we show up, the kids are already out. So we can't. In other words, the idea was when the woman is giving birth, the mother, the midwife could quietly, if she wanted to, you know, twist the neck of the baby and kill the baby without the mother knowing about it, right? If they wanted to, all right? But they say, we couldn't do it. We show up, they're already done. What's the fourth stage of the oppression of the Egyptian?
The overt killing of all those kids.
Right, it makes a general order. All people, every boy, every Jewish boy, throw into the Nile.
Wait, so Rabbi, when it says Paro gave orders to all his people, does that mean to all the Jewish people or to everybody, including Egyptians?
Well, probably the most immediate is all of the people in his government.
Okay.
That would be the most immediate sense.
Is the accent really on him? Sorry.
Another possibility is, as you're saying, the Egyptian people.
Is the accent on his or all? Because if it's on, if his is accented, then it means government. If it's all, then it's all Egyptians.
Okay, well, that's a good question. Let me. Okay. Let me check the pasuk. Let me look. I gotta look at the actual Hebrew. Look at the Hebrew. Okay, let's take a look together. Here we go. I like using this Al Azhar site. It has also Hebrew and English. Vayitzav Paro l'chol amo le'mor, and Paro said, commanded his people, his nation, saying, "Kol ha'ben ha'yelod ha'yor tashkuv v'kol ha'batachin." Now, his nation again could be understood in I think let's see Rashi on that. I'll put the English on. All right, so he says concerning his people, even they felt, okay, this is a whole Midrash again. The Midrash answer is that they even had their own people drowned because they thought this was a bad day that the Savior of Israel would come. Okay, that's a more Midrashic answer. Let's see if we can find another, get a more Pshat-based answer. I'm going to go to mine. Let's take a look at this. I'm gonna go to. Let's take a look at our good friend, the Ibn Ezra. Okay, and he says. Okay. All right. Okay. All right. He doesn't address that issue. All right. Let's go on to another thing. Okay, let's get into now. I want to get to today. The Ramban has an entire approach here, which I want to share with you, which is pretty interesting. Okay, let's have somebody read. All right, Michael Doe, Bavakasha.
Cool. Come, let us be coming with that people, that part.
Yeah.
If Paro really felt threatened by the nation of Israel, why did he not simply annihilate them? Rambam analyzes Paro's behavior.
Now, this is the Ramban. He lived after the Rambam. He's a Sephardic rabbi. He's a Kabbalist. He actually wrote the first commentary on the Chumash that has a Kabbalistic commentary as well. This is his non-Kabbalistic comments on the Parsha. Let's go on.
You want the Hebrew or just the English?
Should read the English, yeah.
Paro and the wise men who served as advisors did not see fit to strike the Israelites down, but as to openly attack them. For it would have been a great act of treachery to strike down for no reason the people who had come to settle in the land by command of the previous king. Furthermore, the populace of Mitzrayim would not have given the king permission to commit such an injustice, for he was, after all, consulting with them about this matter. Moreover, the children of Israel were a numerous and strong people and would undoubtedly wage a great war against the Mitzrim if the Mitzrim had tried to kill them outright. Rather, instead of killing them, sorry, just lost it. There we are.
One second. Okay.
I see. Instead of killing them, he said to his people that they should act with cunning, so that the people of Israel should not realize that the Mitzrim were acting towards them with enmity. Therefore, he initially merely levied on them a conscription of laborers, for it is, after all, normal for strangers living in a given country to supply a conscription of laborers to the king of that country, as mentioned by Scripture in regard to Shlomo.
Okay, so let's do the phasing. All right, so what problem does, according to the Ramban, does Paro have? What's his problem with the Jews? What's his Jewish problem, which he needs his own final solution for?
They're already too strong for him to do anything about them outright.
That's one problem. What else? Why can't he just kill them?
His own people wouldn't tolerate it.
That's the bottom line. In other words, he has to deal with cunning, with chachma, with wisdom, and he has to basically do a covert war against the Jews. because A, they were invited as regal guests, number one. The Egyptians would not even tolerate them to do it. And quite frankly, no matter how powerful a king is, he still is not more powerful than his people. So he has to work with his people. What are his people willing to do? So basically, Paro has to do something. His first step is something that was done in the ancient world, that if you're a foreigner coming to live there, you have to dedicate some time to work for the public works, okay? You know what I mean? It's a national project. You got to help out. All right, let's go.
Okay, continue?
Yeah.
He then talks about the erosion of Jewish rights progress incrementally to outright genocide.
Okay, so basically, this is in this way, the way the Ramban is going to depict it, Paro is very much similar, not exact, but similar to Hitler. He uses covert and propagandic methodology. Here we go. One sec, did I skip?
Okay, go on. Okay. After this, he commanded the midwives in secret to kill the males on the birth stool, so that even the women giving birth, whose babies would be killed, would not know about the midwives and their murderous deeds. After this, he commanded to all his people, that is, every son that will be born into the river shall you throw him, you yourselves as private citizens. And the idea of telling... Oh, sorry, do you want to stop there?
Hold on one second. I just want to make sure that I didn't skip a paragraph. One second. Give me a little second over here.
Keep going, or?
Yeah, keep on going.
And the idea of telling the people to do this themselves was that he did not want to command his executioners to kill the Israelites by the king's sword with Bez as official government policy. Nor did he want that the executioners themselves should throw the Israelite babies into the river, for that too would give the appearance of official sanction. Rather, he said to the Egyptian people that whenever any one of them would find a little Jewish boy, he should throw him into the river. And if the murdered boy's father would complain to the king or to the official in charge of the city, they would profess outrage and tell him to bring witnesses to the murderer so that he could take vengeance against the perpetrator. And then, once the king's strap was loosened, the Egyptians began to search Israelite houses, entering them at night in concealment and removing the little boy from there. This is why it is stated she could not hide him any longer. It would appear, though, that the situation persisted for only a relatively short time. For when Aharon was born, 3 years before Moshe, the decree was not yet in force, and it apparently became abolished shortly after Moshe was born. And why did the decree become abolished at this point? Perhaps Paro's daughter, in her compassion for Moshe, told her father that he should not do so, that is, kill the Israelite babies any longer. Alternatively, when it was heard, that as it became known to the Israelites that the idea to kill the Israelite children originated with the king, he abolished it. Alternatively, it was in accordance with the information told to Paro by the astrologers, as our sages of blessed memory said. Whatever the reason for the abolition of the decree at that point, Ramban concludes, for everything Paro did was in the realm of being cunning with the Israelites, so that the injustice being perpetrated would not become known to them, lest they fight back against the Mithraim. And then he brings support for that Paro acted cunning and deceit towards the Israelites. Want this part read too?
Yeah.
This is the explanation of the statement of those who said to Moshe, for you have made your very scent abhorrent in the eyes of Paro and the eyes of his servants to place a sword in their hands to murder us. They meant to say that, now the Egyptians will increase their hatred of us and use as an excuse the accusation that we are rebelling against the government. And they will now kill us with a sword that has attacked us in plain view without needing to do so any longer by subterfuge.
Okay. All right, so here's a couple questions. According to the Ramban, what was very important for Paro during the entire four steps of the enslavement of the Jews, from enslavement, from taxation, to genocide. What was very important for Paro?
He didn't want to his hands. He didn't want his hands to be dirty in it. He was almost putting the job on other people. Are we still comparing it to Nazi Germany?
Right, correct. In other words, it's very important that he has to be officially what? Identified as being officially neutral or positive toward the Jewish members of the society. Okay? Two, what was important for his government?
To never stoke rebellion.
Right, against his own people, but again, in regards to the Jews.
Well, he couldn't command his own people to do something that would cause them to rebel, nor could he do something that would cause the Jews to rebel.
But also, no, it's more than that. It's that he pretended, he made like a farce that like the government cared about Jewish babies being abducted and killed. So he like transformed the show into the government and the government officials, but we know that no one really cared.
Right. So that's a classic situation. This happened in Nazi Germany in the 30s when it was officially, there was no final solution. And, you know, Jews would complain that they're getting terrorized, et cetera. And they would go and they would say, and they would express outrage. You should bring away, this is a terrible thing. But once the people knew, there was a quiet signaling to the anti-Semites that if you do something against the Jews, you're not going to get busted for it. So basically, he wants to say that he said he was communicating to the not to the citizens, you know, all his people should throw. But not the official government. In other words, it wasn't government workers. And apparently that would indicate what was happening among the regular civilians of Egypt, according to the Ramban's depictions. What was their attitude toward the Jews? And once they saw they're not going to get busted for attacking the Jews.
They seem to be getting more sympathetic towards him.
Right. They were okay with that. In fact, they say they start searching the houses because it says in the next chapter that Yocheved, Moshe's mom, who secretly had little baby Moshe, she couldn't keep him hidden because obviously the kid's crying, you know, kids get old, they cry. And what's happening? You know, apparently people are going house to house. So it's like, you know, the Nazis used civilians to extremely powerful effect to do the Nazi dirty work. So first of all, if you were members of the Nazi party, they had all these different kinds of groups. You had the SS, you had the Gestapo, you had the Hitler Youth. They were all used very adroitly, very carefully to achieve Hitler's goals. And these goals, he wanted to basically not be exposed by the world. In fact, he had an entire, when the Red Cross would come, after hearing allegations of tremendous genocide in the concentration camps, had them come to Theresienstadt, and they would do the whole show, and there are their kids, and they're playing in the swimming pool, and everything's going great, and they did this whole lie until the people would come, and you know the Red Cross people would come and inspect and leave, and once they left, they go back to the whole thing. So very similarly, Paro and Hitler were very sensitive to opinion of their people and world opinion. And they both did whatever covert attacks, collusion, subterfuge, to basically get the job done that the Jewish people would be controlled and destroyed. Hitler, of course, took this to the greatest extent, the final solution. But this idea of using trickery and subterfuge and using your own citizenry as your willing executioners, which we saw so tragically in World War II. Not only, by the way, who were the most brutal ones in World War II? Not just the Germans.
It was the Poles.
The Waffen. You're talking about the SS?
Not just
the Polish. The Polish citizens were by far the worst.
So you had the Polish, and you had the Lithuanian, and you had the and the Ukrainian. Each citizenry, all there, what they call the Nazi collaborators, in every single country in Europe.
And the French, too, right?
What?
The French.
And the French.
Collaborators.
And they would go house to house and helping the Nazis find hidden Jews and rooting them out. And I'm saying the Ramban, writing this in the 1200s, depicting the intrigue of Paro, tragically forecast the very same thing that we saw acted out on a much grander scale by Hitler, his propaganda experts of Goebbels, the willing executioners and collaborators in every single country that they occupied. It's the same idea.
President Trump on Tuesday.
So the similarities are great, but it's very tragic.
And that of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un.
All right, any questions about this? So this, by the way, I bring this up to your attention. This is something which is very good. If you can save this, when you want to have a question, a conversation piece, you can share this. I send it to you guys. For your Seder, if you want to get people engaged, and our most American Jews will have a decent knowledge of the Holocaust. And what you can impress them with is how the Ramban's careful reading of the first 11 verses of the four stages of the enslavement mirrors so many of the same tactics and strategies of the Nazis. So you can get a nice little conversation going at your Seder and depicting, because what I like about the Ramban's point is that you know when you think about the Egyptians, you think about people wearing these white little funny outfits and with these weird haircuts and these weird, you know, weird jewelry and walking around the pyramids and, you know, making the Jews, you know, schlep bricks in the sun. That's one thing, but what the Ramban has successfully done, it shows you that they are using the same methodology of mass control of their own population, manipulation, propaganda, as well as the Jews. It's the same thing. It shows you a sophisticated way of how a tyrant artfully manipulates his own people and the people that he wants to oppress, and carefully balances it so it can get the job done. And that's, you'll see that basically Paro in many ways was an evil genius, not as bad as Hitler, but not so different in many ways. Okay? Questions? Comments? All right.
Thank you.
All right, guys. Have a great night.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.